Welcome back to After the End of History, the podcast about history and international relations. If you're tuning in for the first time, welcome to Season 3, where Mario and I will be taking a closer look at the news around the Russia-Ukraine war. You can find the full recording on Patreon, where you can support us for as little as a buck a month, just to help keep the lights on over here. And if you're trying to decide whether you want to support us at all, you can check out previous seasons on Spotify or Apple, and you can find the full first two seasons there for free. So tonight, our second episode of the season, we're discussing how foreign policy intellectuals from a breadth of political views have responded to the war over the last 3 months. Really 4 months. I guess we're coming up on 4 months now. So we're talking about IR theorists like Wertheim and Kupchin, to the more left-oriented Alexander Zevin at the New Left Review, and Thomas Meany, who appears in various journals, but a longer piece that we'll talk about from The Guardian. And we've noticed some patterns in the discussion that we've tracked since we started the podcast a couple years ago. So from questions about the stability of U.S. hegemony to the left's abandonment of anti-imperialist politics, the writers that we're talking about give a really nice view, a deep view of the intellectual debates that war has re-energized. So we don't agree with everything here, but we did come up with a collection of articles that have a general feature in common that we do appreciate, and that's the urgency of restraint today, the restraint in American military affairs, the restraint in the U.S. Running roughshod over the world, essentially. So we seem to have arrived at a moment where restraint seems impossible and yet perhaps never more important than the present. But we're not exactly optimistic. You know, if you listen to the show in the past, I think, you know, we kind of have a pessimistic streak, and not less because of what we're reading here. So I want to warn listeners that we don't offer a solution necessarily. And it's increasingly clear that our rulers may be on a path towards prosecuting a new Cold War, and that the prospects of a negotiated settlement, like we talked about last time, probably shouldn't be taken for granted. And, you know, neither has the anti-NATO left particularly provided even an iota of material resistance to what the United States is prosecuting now as a proxy war. So if you need a trigger warning, we'll just say the situation is bleak from where we stand. But with that, without crying or laughing, we just really seek to understand. So, yeah, I guess that's my long-winded introduction to this episode. If you want to hear the whole thing, again, give us a nod over at Patreon. Just a buck a month will get you access to all of our latest recordings and, of course, the backlog of what we've done for almost 3 years at this point. So I'll pause there. Mario, I'm going to turn it over to you. Anything I missed there?
No, that's a perfect introduction. I can't believe it's been 3 years. It's in the third year. We're starting the third year.
In our third year. Yeah. It's like, I guess, our third summer doing this.
So we're juniors in the school of podcasts.
In the podcast game. Yeah. I mean, we're late bloomers, I guess. But yeah,
I'll say that. I can truce that. You gave a good introduction. I thought that we could do something with this, you know, the intellectual responses to this war, in a way, something similar to what Perry Anderson did in his analysis of American foreign policy intellectuals. And as you said, we're basically choosing people, for the most part, who are in various ways counseling for restraint in the sort of escalation or in the development of this war, and warning against the different tracks or different routes to escalation. And as you were saying, we chose Alexander Zevin, who wrote a piece in Sidecar of New Left Review called A Normal War, which was, I thought, a very good kind of typology of liberal humanitarian responses and their logical kind of correlations. Also, someone who we like a lot is Meany, who's written a bunch of other pieces before that we've talked about, I think. That's to say Thomas Meany.
That's right, Thomas Meany.
We'll talk also about Stephen Wertheim, who wrote a book called Tomorrow the World, which we'll have a chance to talk about some more. And, of course, Charles Kupchin wrote a piece shortly after the outbreak of the war called Putin's War in Ukraine is a Watershed, Time for America to Get Real. And yeah. I also, for, you know, maybe not going to be handled in this episode, but we should also talk about a piece written by Robert Kagan in response to the war. We should also talk about some New Left Review articles that came out in a double issue, I guess, about a month and a half ago, which included pieces by Susan Watkins, Volodymyr Yushchenko, someone who's been our kind of, you know, touchstone for trying to understand Ukrainian politics, Tony Wood, who wrote a book on Russia, on a book called Russia Without Putin, who takes a kind of, you know, a anti-Putin oligarchic and anti-imperialist sort of stance against Russia's war. And who else? Oh, another person I would like to include in the pile is Samuel Charup, who is at the RAND Corporation, but has been writing a lot of stuff on, you know, for a number of years. And he's about our age, but has been writing stuff for a few years about possible solutions to the security dilemma in Eastern Europe in relationship to Russia. And maybe we'll throw a few more in on the pile by the end of these couple episodes. But what I think they do a good job of is basically charting out the constellation of ideological responses, and most of them are for restraint. And now, of course, the outlier in all of them is Robert Kagan, who's always, you know, whose wife is actually immediately involved in a lot of the political machinations that are making this conflict all the more precarious for the entire world. And we'll also have opportunity from there to probably talk about the Institute for the Study of War and all the sort of uses, propagandistic uses that have been put or that have been made with their daily or weekly reports on the process or the progress of the war there.
Who is Kagan's wife? Why didn't you want to say her name?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought, well, our listeners would know. I thought they would just know. Victoria Nuland.
Yeah.
Fuck the EU Nuland.
Yeah, yeah. It's maybe a name that could not be spoken or something. Mm. A name that shall not be said. Yeah, fuck the EU. That's right. So, yeah, it's all...
Yats is our guy. Yats is our guy.
Yeah, yeah. The pieces that we're talking about tonight, we tend to agree with more, and you're mentioning a few people like, you know, Kagan, who, you know, we definitely have a lot of disagreements with, which we've spoken about in previous episodes, like you said, going back to Anderson, and he was, along with Kupchin, among those counsels to the princes that he criticizes so fiercely. But here we have a number of, you know, Thomas Meany, we've got Zevin, people that, you know, we would say we share a lot in common with politically. But even here, you know, that this idea of restraint being on the order of the day, it's sort of a weak response, you know, in the realm of possibility. There's kind of a coming to terms with the power of the United States, and there's not a whole lot that can be done about you know, this military machine that's been running on the inertia of hegemony, you know, and sort of this, you know, Cold War kind of thinking for decades now. So there's kind of restraint is sort of, it seems like the best of all possible worlds at the moment. And there's not much, and this is sort of a product of the left not being active on the ground, but there's not much by way of, you know, sort of radical anti-imperialist politics. It's what's possible at the moment. And there's kind of an existential sort of dread in some of these articles that we are really facing, you know, the precipice. So maybe we can start with that by speaking about Alexander Zevin's piece.
Alexander Zevin, I think he's a professor or associate professor right at CUNY. He wrote a book a few years ago called Liberalism at Large, The World According to the Economist, which was basically a kind of inventory or a 150-year type analysis of The Economist magazine's responses to different geopolitical and economic crises, and you know, kind of gives a take or a analysis of the sort of quintessential center liberal response to all of them. And I think the only time I haven't read the book, but I saw him give a talk, and it was attended by Adam Tooze as a kind of discussant. And he is, so I think for this, you know, he's very well placed to provide a kind of panorama of the ideological constellation of Western commentary on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And he's very good, I think, at describing the kind of explosion of political, like, affect in response to the war in Ukraine, especially the sort of social media texture to it all. And the tendency towards, running above, ahead of our, not to mix metaphors, but going ahead of our ski tips in full-throated support and not examining either the causes of the conflict or the nature of the regime in Ukraine and various other sort of pitfalls in that sort of, I would argue, you know, kind of well-modulated, hysterical kind of tone to our politics today as it involves this crisis.
Yeah, he wrote this before Ben Stiller showed up and called Zelensky his hero.
That's right.
But he kind of nailed it, and he saw where, you know, the cultural the politics of this whole thing was going, and now it's gotten to the point of just total absurdity. Why is Ben Stiller there? Like, what the hell does he contribute to this? It's just
he's elbowing his way in there to be the authoritative interpreter of Zelensky so that he can play him in a biopic.
That sounds right, actually.
Yeah. Meet the fakers.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you there with my.
No. No, because there is like, I mean, you just can't escape this sort of Baudrillardian kind of hyper-reality aspect of all this stuff. I mean, that's been the case with war in America since the Iraq War, obviously. But this is a kind of, this war is sort of unprecedented in the way that social media sets the tone for how people interpret what's going on. And, you know, the flood of images, the fog of war is actually a kind of garish flood of images of small groups of people, you know, using javelins to attack tanks, video footage from drones or otherwise showing small skirmishes, and those being the basis or those being evidence of advances for one side or the other. Pro-Russian people tending to gravitate towards the social media platform Telegram, where they share their information, they share images. People on Twitter or Facebook and elsewhere. Facebook, as the war began, took off the ban on Azov Battalion, or voicing pro-Azov Battalion sentiments. So we'll get to that. But I think overall, those are just accelerations of larger trends that are both a part of the sort of liberal intelligentsia commentariat's kind of way of perceiving the war, which involved both the kind of hyper-moralization of the conflict right from the get-go, absolutizing Putin as evil, and therefore incapable of, you know, entering into agreements with or negotiating with, and then constant references to Munich in 1939. Mm-hmm. That at least captures the way captures the initial response on, you know, most liberal media responses. And just to, as a note, I just saw something today, a very pro NATO piece by Slavoj Žižek in The Guardian.
Another one, huh?
So
yeah, I think, was it about pacifism is not the
not
the
pacifism right is not enough. Ukraine is fighting. Yeah. We have to support them. NATO is good.
Yeah, so you're talking about, I think, one of the better parts of this article. I like it a lot. It's called A Normal War, I believe is the title.
Mm-hmm.
It's published in Sidecar, if we didn't say that already. But I like it for many reasons. One, it has a good and had an early description of the orientation of the left from, you know, the nation through, you know, the Social Democrats in the United States here.
Yeah.
In the Jacobin sect or whatever. But what you're talking about in terms of social media and cultural politics, I think, is spot on. And it's, you know, he captures what's unique in this war as far as that stuff goes. But it's interesting, though, that the article is titled The Normal War, and he's trying to capture the continuity with United States politics, foreign policy, United States foreign policy going back to the Iraq War, sanctions regimes against Iran, et cetera. So there are some unique aspects of this war, but at the same time, there's running continuity with the playbook, you know, on regime change that the neocons began to implement after September 11th. So could you give us a picture of his argument there?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just read a quote from him. Banning Russian banks from SWIFT is now old hat. Financial warfare for the faint-hearted. More radical measures aim at provoking overlapping debt, currency, and banking crises. A block on Russian banks from dollar clearing and settlement. A ban on trading in its debt on secondary markets. And seizure of two-thirds of its dollar reserves. You know, he also thinks this falls into the kind of, you know, pattern or a kind of... is continuous with kind of cancel culture instincts within the culture at large, and allows people to basically deflect the role of the United States in creating conditions of basically a security dilemma and a kind of condition in which Russia has reasons to be paranoid about Western ambitions near Russia's borders. And he writes, by refusing to reflect on either the deeper causes of the war or possible ways out of it, the liberal commentariat in the U.S. falls into usual patterns in which America figures as the innocent abroad, a do-gooder for whom crisis is something external to be acted on, never something it could be responsible for. And I think he, you know, there's a kind of synchronization of both this sort of this strategic leveraging of these instruments, of the sanctions instruments in the financial sector, plus cutting Russia off to advanced technology, you know, especially in aerospace, but also in its, you know, energy exporting infrastructures. But that now combined with huge inflows of war material to Ukraine gives this conflict a kind of a seriously escalatory dynamic in which Russia has every reason to think that it's fighting NATO and the US mm-hmm. while it wages war on Ukraine. And Zevin does a good job of combining all this with the effluvia of the culture industry. He writes, the rush to do something, which takes a certain pride in not having thought through the consequences. What has changed is not just the erosion of the unipolar moment, but the multiplication of pathways for virtual war, for participating in it, and being manipulated by it. Crowdfunding urban militias on Twitter, posting videos on captured tanks or army cats to Instagram and TikTok. The result is somewhere between war as the health of the state and war as self-care, with ballerinas, pianists, painters, and scientists disinvited from fellowships or shows against blue and yellow banners and emojis at no cost to Americans doing it.
Yeah, it's a good line.
And that line, war is the health of the state, you know where that's from?
It sounds kind of fashy.
No, it's Randolph Bourne, who was a great anti-war, you know, World War I anti-war voice, who wrote a couple pieces, one called Twilight of the Idols in response to John Dewey's support of World War One, but also I want to say war is the health of the state as just a kind of cultural existential response to the unprecedented mobilization that he saw in America of all places.
He was saying it critically. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Right. I see. Yeah. He didn't believe this. He saw that as a fact of life and not a good one.
All right.
Yeah, so there's a lot of inertia here, and you know, Zevin really does a good job putting out there's an uncritical march to war, and the escalatory aspects of it are really quite dangerous. But he also points out that there's not the same kind of there is at least a milieu out there that is cautious and represent it in mass popular culture. So not, I'm not just talking about the Mearsheimer video that got like, you know, 25 million views or whatever on the Primrose Path going back to 2015. He's talking about like Tucker Carlson, that there is that, you know, the cultural, you know, the cultural elite or the media elite are not in lockstep behind this war. And this is very much the Democrats' war. And unlike, it seems unlike Bush's war, this was like, you know, the GOP's war in Iraq, there is a little bit of a split between, you know, the two wings of the bourgeoisie here. And so you get sort of Tucker Carlson's critique on Fox News. I think it's the largest news base or audience base in the country. And he points that out. So there seems to be, you know, there seem to be some fissures here that doesn't make this exactly normal in the course of American military affairs.
No, I think that's totally right. I mean, if I had told you 10 years ago that Democrats would be pushing for a war against Russia and the possibility of World War III, while people like Tucker Carlson or Tulsi Gabbard, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard wasn't on the scene 10 years ago, I don't think, but that Tucker Carlson would be called a traitor by most right. liberal Democrats, you wouldn't have believed me, right?
Right, right.
And so there's a weird, I mean, I guess it's in certain ways predictable or whatever, but in certain ways not so surprising. But it's this: the fact is that Tulsi Gabbard and Tucker Carlson were roundly called traitors by Mitt Romney and others. I'm sure Liz Cheney and plenty of those other types of people chime in alongside center-left Democrats who don't think they're sufficiently bellicose. As Evan points out, that there's a kind of, you know, there are various people he talks about. He talks about Mearsheimer, Branko Milanovic, who we've talked about on the podcast, Peter Beinart, I don't know who that is, but also the conservative columnist Ross Douthat, who's writes for the New York Times. They've all expressed, the need for restraint. So those are the people on the, well, excluding Branko Milanovic, people on the sort of center right. And also excluding Tulsi Gabbard. But he also talks about Katrina Vanderhoevel, the widow of Stephen Cohen, who, also editor of The Nation, condemned the Russia's invasion, but also the rank irrationality and arrogance of U.S. officials who drive to extend a military alliance to Russia's borders. And she called on Biden to press for an immediate ceasefire. These elements of the American left are actually a lot better than the British left, where people like George Monbiot and Paul Mason. We could do a whole episode about what the Gray Zone uncovered about that snitch of snitches, Shah on snitches. But they all called for massive military stimulus to prepare for the coming global conflagration. The American left, which is quite afflicted these days, but that which would have to include the DSA, Jacobin dissent, people who write for The Intercept. Should be noted that the Squad has voted, and I think all of them voted unanimously for the $40 billion military package. Mm-hmm. They tend to see Russia as this transnational force of conservatism and right-wing populism, and therefore, I think, easily fall in line to oppose it. That puts in check all of their anti-imperialist inclinations.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back further, too. I mean, it's always, you know, Russia is an anti-gay country that repressed the Pussy Riot, and, you know, there's always sort of been that. Tony Wood talks about this stuff a lot. We can get into it then. But I think it's all of those features, sort of the identity politics and the sort of the cultural leftism that's all sort of weaved together in that narrative makes it very easy for them to get caught up in this trap of pro-imperialism. And as much as, you know, what Zevin captures here with the way that politics has been scrambled, you know, you have these characters like Tucker Carlson, who's a traitor now for taking the right position, being critical of this war, this proxy war, saying it right up front. But then you have the American left going right into the arms of Biden and these Russia hawks. It's very complex, very confusing. But what he nails is that the left, right, the American left, like the Social Democrats and Jacobins, they can kind of they can critique the United States spending all of this money, kind of like a butter not guns kind of attitude. Yeah. But in principle, they're not. You know, it's not an anti-imperialist or anti-American global hegemony position.
Yeah, well, because, and the other thing he underscores is they're also afraid of being called tankies.
Tankies, exactly. There's the tanky phenomenon. They're too scared of, if they come out and if they're critical of this, then you are necessarily pro-Putin. Yeah. That's always the trap here. So they don't want to go that far. And that's sort of the nature of politics now. It's all or nothing. If you tend towards anything that looks pro-Putin, you're subject to being canceled as a tankie. And like everything about this, like that the entire cultural vibe right now is mixed into this.
Right, and it falls in line with, I guess, a larger phenomenon, which we know, I guess, has really been in tow, at least totally noticeable to us since COVID, but you could trace it to the response to Trump, a kind of authoritarian left, the cancel culture aspect, a kind of tendency to crowd out critical voices, right? And that dynamic is one that's easily yoked to the interests of the powerful, especially when many of the issues at stake are not laid out in a principled fashion, but instead are part of a general kind of, emotional atmosphere, right, of responses, of ethical injunctions to help, to stop the violence, or and stop an aggressor and stuff like that. This is very much, even though there are lots of new aspects to it in terms of social media and the extent of, you could say, the propaganda efforts against Russia in the United States since Russiagate, they're very typical liberal responses to conflict and to war. Yeah. And you can really chart these types of responses all the way back to World War I. And, I think you and I have talked about this book by Daniel Pick, War Machine, Rationalization of Slaughter in the Modern Age, in which, he charts this sort of psychoanalytic discourse, and you could say general cultural criticism about or cultural criticism of that era, that really captured how much the war effort and the sentiments leading to the war felt like a kind of conveyor belt that couldn't be stopped. Mm-hmm. Once it gets going, you really just can't stop it, and it's a kind of inexorable machine that draws you in. And that's why I really like this piece, is because it gives you a kind of sense of what liberal bellicosity is like. It has all the best intentions in the world when it starts out.
I think he points out that they're all in favor of sanctions. I mean, they're not in favor of a full-on, they're not calling for some real lunatics out there, a no-fly zone. They weren't on board like the somewhere. I think Paul Mason actually, in the British left might have actually called for a no-fly zone early on. Or I know he's had sort of some lunatic ideas, but the American left hasn't gone that far. They've pushed for sanctions, and they voted, positively for those. And I think the idea, the way that this gets packaged, is that the sanctions will, they'll hurt oligarchs, and that seems humane enough. It's going to, what do we care about oligarchs and their yachts? And I remember early on in the war, there were these images like out of Italy in different places where these yachts were being, buckets of red paint thrown on them and, spray painted over, no to war and all this. And the conception was these sanctions are actually good because it's going to hit the, oligarchs in the pocket. It's going to split Russian society down the middle, and Putin will be out of office soon enough. This is the humane way of bringing about regime change. And it allowed them to actually take a position that was pro-war while also kind of taking the moral high ground and saying this is about leveling the conditions of Russian society so that Putin and his cronies are taken out. not a no-fly, not military intervention, but a humane sanctions regime.
Which goes to show you how much Americans have just become inured or just become used to sanctions as a feasible and as a best practice for trying to affect the behavior of other states. Even though, as we've discussed here, and we'll have reason to discuss again in other episodes, the record on sanctions affecting the behavior of other states is very bad. And right. It also shows the degree to which, on that basis, they're very much willing to fall in line with regime change policies. And I think it's hard to deny that it was a regime change policy, given Joe Biden's slip of, this man cannot stay in power. But it shows you that that's not really that much of a policy of restraint. You shouldn't want to try to overthrow a leader, I don't think, anyway. There are plenty of reasons to argue against the view that you should overthrow a leader who handles 6,000 nuclear weapons. And it also shows that they don't have any conception, or they, at least at the time, when the fervor about and reaction to the outbreak of war began, they didn't have a conception that most Russians might actually think this war is necessary. One thing Zevin also, mentions is William Burns' memo, Niet means Niet, about the just explaining to the foreign policy establishment here in the United States, to the State Department and others, that expansion of NATO, especially to Ukraine and Georgia, was a neuralgic point for Russia. It was a total security risk to them, and there was no ambiguity there. So since 2008, this has been something many people within the intelligence services and other, disempowered elements within the foreign service or whatever have known about. Anyone could have known, but they push for it anyway. And another thing also about this, just one last thing about the tech, how things are so weird and askew. Because the left in America is so weak, all they do is trail the DNC in ways like that are, even worse than when we were, just out of college. But because they do that, they never voice proper opposition to Russiagate. So they can't oppose this. They know they need to ride the wave of anti-Trump / anti-Russia hysteria. The two things go so much hand in hand in America, or at least have been for the last few years. And as we're running up to another election cycle, I just think it's going to get 10 times worse, and it's going to be very hard for any political tendency within the DNC to oppose this stuff.
I mean, it's what does he say about the squad here? He calls them out specifically, and I think he says they kind of have an in-between position between the Mearsheimer, you'll call that the voice of caution and restraint, and the Paul Mason type, who would be let's put it bluntly, for the destruction of the left that is critical towards the war, basically. So they kind of have the squad's position is we can call it the U.S.'s fault in some sense, but they'll never get close to a critique of NATO.
Right.
Because what did Trump want to do to NATO? Then you sound Trumpian almost, and that's, this is liberals' hair on fire here, as you've said before. So they kind of distance themselves from that. There's not a principled critique of NATO in any of these voices from the left. You do see some of that in Europe, but we don't get that from this piece so much as in the Meany, which we'll talk about later. Thomas Meany does go through the history of anti-NATO activism throughout, Europe, and where the stakes are the highest, and we see some of that today. I know the youth movement in Italy still retains a large part of that sentiment. But I do want to say a couple other things about this piece, just to close out on it. the normal war, right? Going back to that title, you made a good point earlier in talking about how there, you know, the going back to the top of this discussion, where the deeper causes of the war, there's no reflection on the inertia that drives the narrative, or the, you know, how can $40 billion be written off so quickly without an iota of resistance? So in that way, it does look like a normal war, but there are actually, broader patterns of continuity across the political spectrum, as you point out. You know, I'm looking at our notes, but, on the acceptance of regime change. And I think what you're getting at there is that the only real disagreement across the political spectrum, at least in the United States, is the right way of pursuing regime change. And this is kind of how he frames the point at the end of his article.
I think that we could reflect on this too. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff in the piece, but most of the public sentiment in the West basically accepted the prospect of a regime change policy. I think it's worth reflecting on how, at least now, with a little bit more hindsight, a couple of months hindsight, we can see that a lot of that is backfiring, right? And it's backfiring because Americans are very used to these policies not affecting them, and then falling in the background of their attention. No matter how many civilians die, no matter how many children can't get, medical assistance. And this has been going on since, the Iraq war sanctions, right? And it may be the case that Russia pulls off a kind of judo move that directly affects the
he actually like an honorary member of like International Judo Society or something?
He's clearly revoked. He's like a judo spirit animal now at this point, and with what he's pulling off. I mean, he's going to be affecting the pocketbooks of the general West, the collective West, in ways they never could have imagined 3 months ago. No matter what you want to say one way or the other about the wisdom of the policy, that is a fact now.
Yeah, man. The ruble is the Times currency of the year.
Face. It's not rubble, I'll tell you that.
That's right. Yeah.
But no. And so the sort of ease with which Americans and people in the West were willing to just go all in on a whole slew of policies that, in toto, I can understand why the West needs to do things against Russia, right, in response to aggression, right, or in their logic and in their own way of viewing the world and the nature of this issue, why they would have to do something. But because they threw the kitchen sink at Russia, there is no incentive for them to change course, and instead for them to deepen the negative effects it is going to have on the West while they pursue their military objective. And they didn't conceive the possibility that Russia would be stronger than Iraq or stronger than, Yemen or Iran, right? They didn't recognize the integral nature of Russian energy in the entire energy mix of Western Europe and in the global supply of oil or the global supply of energy. This, I think, is because of a deeper, and this also has to do with the larger continuities of liberal sentiment in relationship or in response to wars. I mean, if you look at the history of sanctions in the interwar period, there's a general acceptance of sanctions as a kind of anti-war policy that will nonetheless, create conditions that will blockade, possibly starve civilian populations, but at least avoid the outright bloodshed of warfare. Even though people at that time realized that the origin of the blockade came from war and the effort to so impoverish and so and create conditions of famine in belligerent countries that they would be under such psychological force that they'd either oppose their own, that they'd overthrow their own government or sue for peace. People after the war imagine this as the perfect pacific instrument, right? But throughout the course of this interwar period, as you know, sanctions were used at different scales and to respond to different types of crises, larger powers, Germany and Japan as perfect examples, recognize that the possibility of sanctions created other strategic imperatives to push them to further war. Because they had to secure oil, because they had to secure energy or certain types of materials like rubber and other stuff that they couldn't just produce synthetically, that created all the more of an incentive to pursue conquest, to capture and seize those resources. And so in a way, it has a kind of dialectical like flip, the possibility of one anyway. And I actually think that it's not going to turn out that way in this conflict. But that's only because liberals and the general sentiment and reaction to this conflict didn't properly understand the degree to which Russia can remain autarkic. If Russia actually needed to secure, natural resources in other parts of the world on an extended scale, if it hadn't already nurtured a relationship with China, it wouldn't be able to weather this storm. And it's very possible it would be even more bellicose, or it would even lash out even more. And yeah, I think that that's an interesting kind of way to pose the question of the compare what's worth comparing with World War One, World War Two, and it's something we're often doing in conversation, right? Is thinking about like what is the emerging world conflict looking like? Is it like World War One? Is it like World War Two? I think the sanctions aspect overall might be kind of moot in a sense that they're lucky that the focus of these sanctions policies were on a target like Russia, because they can weather it.
What is the name of the important sanctions book that came out this year that Tuz reviewed?
And we should do an The Economic Weapon by Stephen Mulder, I think.
It sounds like you're bringing a lot of that to bear on how to understand Russia today. I don't know if he gets into that as much as that book is pretty limited to the interwar period.
Yeah, it stops in 40. Yeah.
But you found that it's useful for understanding the current period.
Yeah, definitely.
As you were speaking, I always sort of took for granted that you read Zevin's piece and you go, yeah, no shit, there's no anti-war movement out there because the left has just gotten dumber and more tied to the DNC. And I've always sort of taken it for granted that that's the case. It's a question of consciousness, that consciousness has just degraded. We're farther and farther from the richest anti-imperialist tradition going back to the Bolsheviks, a rich anti-imperialist legacy in the United States itself. But we're decades and decades, several generations removed from that. So that level of combativity has died over time. But the other side of it is, I think, it's worth reflecting on, as you just went through some of the details there, is that war has taken on just a completely different element today. And it's like, it's like playing a video game. You fly some drones, you can sanction a country. When people talk about the Iraq war, they forget that the lead up to that was a sanctions regime that killed, maybe 500,000 people.
Yeah. 500,000 kids, probably a million people. Yeah,
exactly. 500,000 children, and people starved to death. And
I should have said Madeleine Albright before. It slipped my mind, but for some reason, Martha Nussbaum was all that was coming in my head. But it's Madeleine Albright. I don't know why I get them. I get them confused. It doesn't make any sense.
Nussbaum and
I don't know why. Two M names or something like that. It's weird.
It's all right. I'll try to edit that in. you're probably not far off though when you're just capturing their genitals.
Martha Nussbaum is much more respectable. I mean,
yeah, that's true. But I think that's a good place to conclude. I think tonight I want to say, you know, when we outlined this episode months ago, you know, sort of taking inspiration from a book that we both love and did, you know, 10 episodes on, Perry Anderson's American Foreign Policy and His Thinkers, we wanted to do it all in one shot, but obviously this is going to take a lot of you know, a lot more discussion. And I think, you know, what we'll promise to do over the next few weeks is take one of these articles and really deep dive it. So that's what we're going to do. This Zevin piece will link next week. I think what we're going to try to do is get Kupchin and Meany together.
And Wertheim. We can do all three. We can do it.
You could probably do all three. Yeah.
Kupchin and Wertheim.
We'll link those
in
advance in the discussion. Yeah. But I think for tonight, that's probably where we want to stop. This is a pretty rich article. And it's online for free at Sidecar, which is the New Left Review's, I guess, new blog.
Their blog, like, political blog. Very good. Yeah. But it's very good. Always, I think they update it every, you know, twice a week with stuff.
Yeah. So we'll link that for everybody, and then we'll come back next week with further discussion on those three other pieces by Wertheim, Thomas Meany, and Kupchin, who we have notes for from our Anderson piece.
And in the meantime, if people want to watch Kupchin getting ridiculed on Indian talk show television or Indian news media, you can find him on, is it Narwaz or Gerwaz? Where they tend to have like eight talking heads at the same time chiming in to respond to a question, and the host just destroys Kupchin. Even though I don't think it was totally deserved, especially as we'll discuss what Kupchin's piece relates, he just took Kupchin as a kind of poster child or a kind of almost an effigy of American exceptionalism and just ridiculed and upbraided him for about 5 minutes straight. It was pretty funny.
By the way, you said in Toto earlier, and I wanted to ask if you have a favorite Toto song.
Is that a band? I don't know what Toto is.
I bless the rains down in Africa.
I know that. I do know that song. I didn't know it was Toto.
I guess that's really their only song. The right answer is Africa, right?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, that's it for tonight.
Okay. Enjoy. Enjoy, subscribers.
Thanks for listening.